Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Barrett.
And I'm Maria De Meredis, and I am delighted to welcome to our podcast today Professor Anna Maria Rosati from Washington to talk to us about financial literacy. Anna, welcome.
Maria, thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
And this week we are, as you heard, discussing financial literacy. In the last few years, millions and millions of people have started using mobile banking in Europe and in the developing world. And what we gain in efficiency and speed, we may lose in advice and the knowledge of just going into a bank. So financial literacy is becoming an issue in Europe and, well, everywhere around the world, isn't it, Maria?
Yes, it is. I mean, financial literacy, of course, is not a new topic. It's a topic that's been us with a very long time. But as you say, I mean, now that we're moving into a digital age, the issue of financial literacy, I believe, is going to be even more important. And in fact, Anna is here in Brussels today to talk exactly about the way that we can use financial education in the digital age. And dare I say, Bruegel is about to start thinking about these things more structurally, and this is why we want to engage with Professor Rosati. Anna.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. And, you know, I think financial literacy in a digital world is even more important indeed. And I think we also have to remind ourselves that, you know, financial or fintech and financial literacy are complement. It's not, you know, technology is not going to replace, but if any, is going to enhance the importance and the need for financial education.
Perhaps if I may, can we go back a step? Because I'm not sure how our audience actually understands these concepts. Can you tell us a little bit about financial literacy? Typically, when people think about financial literacy, they think about math. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is math, but it's much more than that, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, when I try to describe financial literacy, I say it's a combination of knowledge, confidence, and the capacity to apply that knowledge to the decision-making that is important for the individual. So when we are talking about financial literacy, it's not just, you know, doing the capacity to do calculation, but, for example, knowing your rights and obligations, knowing where to find information, being able to ask the right questions, even to financial advisor. So it is a lot more than math. And it certainly is about also the fundamental topics of financial decision making, but those fundamental topics are very encompassing and they cover many topics.
So how do we know there's a problem here? What do we know about people's rates of financial literacy?
We know this because since probably 2004 or even before, we have been able to do surveys and measure financial literacy in national surveys, not just in major countries, but also around the world. And I think the problem emerged very clear that the level of financial literacy is simply too low, not just around the world, but even in countries with very well-developed financial markets. So you cannot take financial literacy for granted, even in the US, even in the G7 countries. So many people, such a large group of the population, even lack the most fundamental knowledge of at the basis of financial decision making.
And what kind of numbers are we talking about here? You say that how many people, right, you think lack that necessary knowledge?
It's two-thirds. This is how many people, I mean, the large majority lacks the knowledge, not the sophisticated knowledge, but the most basic knowledge, the knowledge of the ABC of finance. And this is the number I've been trying to repeat over and over and over. The large majority of people, you know, do not have the ABC of finance. And, you know, in other words, our knowledge, our financial literacy, even in Italy, even in the G7 countries, is too low now, given the type of financial decision we all have to make.
So you're saying only one third? Let me just understand what you just said.
Yes.
Only one third, proportionally speaking, of population understands enough the information that is required in order to make financial decisions.
Absolutely. So we have tested, for example, can you do a 2% calculation? Do you know the effect of inflation? Do you know the basic of risk diversifications? And what we did see is not only, and let me repeat, one-third, only one-third has this basic knowledge. We are not asking about sophisticated concept. But we see that this knowledge is lacking even for people who have made financial decisions. So it continued to stay today, you know, even when you are around age 50. So in other words, people do not even acquire financial literacy later in life. And that's why I think, you know, we cannot expect people to acquire it. We need some policy intervention.
Now, the whole field of economics is basically predicated on an idea that people make rational financial and economic decisions. But if people aren't financially literate, presumably this is having an effect in the wider economy that we can see?
In fact, I think this is exactly the important question here that you're asking, Nicholas, because it is about the risks. I think this is where we need to sort of concentrate now. We have a financial crisis behind us, hopefully a financial crisis of once in a lifetime, but it was a very big financial crisis. It was very much driven by bad financial decisions. And I don't mean just on the population level, even at the specialist level, financial decisions were wrong. So it is only natural that we need to go back and ask, well, do we really understand the complexity of the system? And if I understand Anna Maria correctly, it's not just about the complexity, but it's also the simple things that we don't understand. And yet we live, certainly in the Western world, we live in a society where financial decisions are an integral part of our well-being. We all buy houses, we all buy cars, we all set up some sort of a pension fund.
Not all of us.
Well, eventually, though, because you're talking about, Anna referred to the 50-year-olds, right? By the age of 50, there will be a big number of people who will have made at least one important financial decision. And in fact, since we're moving into an age of, an era rather, of aging, more and more of us will have to look after ourselves rather than rely on the state to look after us. So more and more of us will have to make these types of decisions, even if it's not all of us.
The world is changing. You know, population is aging. It means that we will have to take care of ourselves later in life. And also, by the way, we'll have to take care potentially of parents. Look at the cost of education. The cost of education is really increasing. Today, you know, the average American is graduating from a college with more than $30,000 in debt. You start your economic life in debt. And, you know, we are all required to make many more financial decisions facing very complex financial market. And look at fintech. We are going to now be able to move money with the click of a button. You know, all of these require, you know, certainly much more than basic knowledge. And we see that we don't have it.
And in fact, can you talk us a little bit about this? Because you've done a very interesting study, which I think will interest our audience, on exactly this intersection between financial decisions being done at the digital era and our level of financial literacy. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah, so we did a study in 2016 looking, for example, at mobile payment and the fact that now, you know, we don't make, you know, we make payment with the click of a button and actually using our phone, right? And all of the new way to in which you are making purchases is with the click of a button. So we have made payment very easy and, you know, we have made them via technology and so on. And so, you know, you might think that this simplifies matter and that people do better. The reality is, first of all, we find that it is people who are the least financially literate that use fintech. So, you know, this negative correlation is already a worrisome one because it means that, you know, technology is used disproportionately by people who have less financial knowledge, not more. And interestingly, the people who use fintech have worse financial outcome, not better. So when we look at the people who use mobile payment, we find that they are more likely to overdraw their checking account. Even simple things like a checking account, they are less likely to save, and they are much more likely to use high-cost method of borrowing. For example, how they manage their credit card or the fact that they even borrow against their future paycheck using payday lenders. We did this study in the U.S. So again, you know, financial technology doesn't necessarily make us savvy. You know, we really need to accompany the use of technology with information and education.
But what do you think drives this result? Because at face value, it's a rather counterintuitive result, right?
It was for us as well. But I think is we have made it very easy to pay, right? Not to borrow. By making it very easy to pay, people might actually buy more. And we have this analogy. When in the US they put in like the Z Pass, the EZ Pass, in other words, you don't have to have a coin anymore in the booth, in the highway. What we have seen is that people never know how much they are paying for passing through the booths and paying for the toll on the road. And it was the booth who introduced the easy payment, so electronic payment, that increased the toll, you know, faster. So people become less sensitive to price, and they also know less potentially how much they are spending.
Yeah.
right? And so it's much easier to spend and than to save. So we, you know, we really need technology as well to, that help us save, not just to pay and not just to spend.
So if I may, then what I get from this is that maybe it shouldn't make it quite as easy to pay. Maybe the threshold of making payments is quite so simple.
Right. I think we need 3-step to pay, not 0-step.
Exactly.
Right. So you really can think about it. And, you know, and really you go through this process because, you know, by making it so easy to spend and to pay, you might end up actually overspending and overpaying.
So the suspicion is that this digital revolution is enabling the worst aspects of our impulsive behavior.
I don't know. You know, there is that risk, I have to say. And we were surprised of this result. I mean, I think there can be a great use of technology potentially, but I don't think we should assume that because we use technology is necessarily great. I think, you know, this is how we have been described the technology that is going to change the world and is going to enable people to make good financial decisions. I would say it's going to enable people to make good financial decisions once it is accompanied by financial education. Technology alone might otherwise not do that.
And in fact, Nicholas, this is a very good question because it brings us to the theme of the week. Everywhere in the news we hear about Libra and what Libra implies. And actually one of the ambitions of Libra, irrespective of what its future is right now, is to actually make things very simple. At the touch of a button, indeed, as you said, Anna, you know, facilitate payments for those in particular who are unbanked. But we know that the unbanked are also those who have the least financial literacy. So there we are, you know, creating risks if you follow the logic of the research that we just heard. So I think it's an important you know, message that you're giving us, Anna, that just because you are maybe digitally savvy, you can pay using the newest technology, doesn't mean that you are financially savvy. And indeed, you may be introducing important risks, which, by the way, can become systemic. It's not just about one household. It can lead to much more systemic problems.
I have great concerns about that and the fact that Libra could probably start or affect, in particular, the countries which have the largest unbanked group of the population. And I always say that, you know, if you do financial inclusion without financial education, you are planting the seeds for the next financial crisis.
Well, yeah, if you go to the Libra website, their main sell seems to be that they're enabling people in the developing world to use fintech with huge degrees of convenience and speed and so on. Now, at the risk of sounding ignorant or arrogant or condescending in any way, some of these countries are places that don't have just a problem with financial literacy. They have a problem with literacy. So to have this really fast-moving finance going through these communities, where millions of people haven't even gone to school, seems highly precarious and risky.
It is indeed, and that's why I think, you know, we have to think about that, because often the, you know, policy on the vulnerable and the unbanked can be highly regressive. You know, these people might pay a much higher cost than the banked people, first of all. But I also want to say that one of my statements is that financial literacy today is like reading and writing. So, you know, it is a basic illiteracy. And, you know, when people are so illiterate, I think, you know, we have to be very cautious in, you know, the instrument we give to them, because the instrument can also backfire.
If you consider how much in the Western world, certainly in Europe and in the US, where most of your research has been done, how much we rely on debt as an instrument for growth, instrument for generating jobs, instrument for generating welfare, debt is at the heart of this, right? And you know, debt is good so long as it's good, but it can turn bad. And what you're saying is that, you know, there are problems there that we need to understand how we can help it, not just from the macro level, but also from the micro level.
Absolutely. And that's why I think debt and the problem with debt has been the first one to, I think, highlight the importance of financial literacy. And it's, to me, obvious why debt is a problem. First of all, debt tends to charge a high interest rate, right? So if you get into trouble, you get into trouble quite fast. And also what we have done in debt, if you look at the instrument where people have problems, for example, subprime mortgages or credit card. What was happening there? That it was almost an unlimited supply of credit, and it was the household who had to determine how much was appropriate for them, what was the adequate amount of borrowing. But if you have low financial literacy and you are given an unlimited supply, you know, it's very easy to overborrow. And I think we have seen this over and over and over. And so that's why, yet again, before you give financial instrument or the capacity to people to, you know, really use those financial instruments, you have to make sure that they know how to use them.
But surely this is a complement to regulation as well, because you can actually limit the supply as well.
Absolutely. And that's why we always say it's an ecosystem. We have to bring an ecosystem, build an ecosystem where people have to make good financial decisions. You know, financial literacy might do very little if what people are exposed to are bad financial instruments, or if there is no regulation, or they don't have access to financial instrument, right? So, of course, financial literacy works really well together with regulation and together with financial inclusion. It's always a trilogy. It's never alone. And we don't want people, in a sense, you know, to become experts so that, you know, there is no need for regulation. Of course, regulation and financial literacy go hand in hand.
But surely this must be... I mean, there must be an argument here, or at least this could be a symptom of the fact that there's just too much financial complexity in our society. It's just endless, because there's this thing where it would take you 20 years to read all the terms and conditions of all the digital services you use, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, or literally anything. People don't have time to discover all the nuances of all the financial products they need just to have an ordinary life, not to do exceptional, amazing entrepreneurship, just to go to university, to get a house, to get a pension and so on. There just isn't time to understand it, and we can't all be experts. Is there an argument to say there is too much of our society is built around the idea of debt, for one thing, and there's just so much complexity, ordinary people can't be expected to understand it?
Yeah, absolutely. The problem is that's the world we face, but I think simplification is incredibly important. You know, sometimes it's hard to simplify, but I think we have to aim to that as well. But I want to repeat it over and over. With financial literacy, we don't want to transform people into experts. I think it's like, in a sense, health, right? I mean, we, you know, people today know and have learned a little bit the good practice so that they can live a healthy life. And, you know, there are good practices like not smoking, walking, you know, eating well. And I think we want this good practice for finance as well. And to do so, you know, believe it or not, we need that basic knowledge, that basic appreciation and that basic awareness. And this is really what we are trying to achieve with financial literacy, not transform anyone into Warren Buffett or really understand the complexity of the world.
And indeed, I mean, the financial decisions that we have to make, we're not expected to understand the finer details. This is why, as Anna said, the regulation is a complement here. It's not a substitute. You need to regulate financial markets, because then you're talking to experts, and consumer welfare and consumer protection comes from that side. This is an important piece of the puzzle that should not be eliminated, and if anything, should be promoted. But an important complement here is the types of financial decisions that we take, understanding when a debt is enough and when is it over-indebtedness. I think these parts we can really help with financial literacy.
And we don't want only to cure the pathology. We want to do prevention as well, right? Curing the disease is often very expensive and also very painful. So let's try to do prevention.
Well, I think there's certainly something to be said for streamlining things. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said that the problem with socialism is it takes up too many evenings. It might be a problem for capitalism as well, just for ordinary people.
Indeed.
I would like to ask a question about people living financially precarious lives. How many people can find $2,000 in a crisis?
Well, we know that figure, because we have asked this question over and over since actually 2009 to 2018. And when we asked this question in 2009, right after the financial crisis, there is a stunning number to report for the US that half of the population didn't have the confidence to come up with $2,000 if something happened and they had a month time. You know, so this really speaks of the financial fragility. 10 years later, 2018, 31% of the population cannot come up with $2,000.
And this is a country where $2,000 isn't an unordinary medical bill.
Exactly. So this is like a mid-sized shock, or potentially even, you know, sometimes a small shock. So many people are still hurting. You know, the balance sheet, the finances have not recovered. And by the way, if you look at some of the population, women, millennials, the number are even bigger, right? So there is still a lot of hurting. There is still a lot of financial fragility in the economy. And this is why, yet again, it's really important to really talk about financial literacy.
Do you know the numbers for Europe when it comes to this financial fragility?
We have only put this question in a few surveys, but we don't have the updated data. And that's why I think it's really important to collect this data, you know, in the US as well. You know, we have just one question, which is such a rich measure, yeah, because it tells you about basically your balance sheet situation. With one question, not only I know about your debt and asset position, but I also know how confident you are. And I just want to mention another question we have asked to complement that, which is actually about financial anxiety. We have asked people if thinking about their finances make them anxious, and how many of them do so. And yet again, in the US in 2018, more than half of the population feels financial anxiety when thinking about their finances. To me, it's a measure of how much the average person is hurting.
It would certainly be important to collect these numbers also in Europe. We are 10 years after the financial crisis. It would be important to have a feel, different countries in the Eurozone and in the EU, how much financial fragile or indeed anxious they are.
And if you don't have this data, you know, it's very hard to do policies, and also it's very hard to design programs that are targeted to the needs of the population. So we have really used this data for program designs.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you don't have that data, you're shooting in the dark.
So can you tell us a little bit about that as well? I know you're also the chair of the Italian group that is now catering for financial literacy. Could you tell us a little bit of which initiatives you're putting in place to try and promote financial health in the context of Italy?
Yeah. So in 2017, a financial education committee was basically put in place in Italy to address more or less lack of financial literacy. And I get to chair this committee. And it's, you know, for me, it was such an honor to do that because, you know, I get to address financial education in my own country. So it was very, very special. So one of the things we did first is construct a portal of financial education. So we want people now who needs information or want some basic knowledge to have a place where they can find rigorous but independent information. And then we have done kind of an overview of all the program that existed to really be able to see how much is done and where can we do more, so that, again, you know, we are using the number to be able to do so. And what we have launched is what one of my favorite initiatives, if I can say, is Financial Literacy Month. So we started in October, and this is the second Financial Literacy Month. And what we have seen is basically a way to mobilize all of the resources. And what we have seen that people are doing financial education from the big city, from Milan to Rome, but also to the small city. And so many institutions, academics, non-for-profit, trade union, many organizations have really bought into the financial education. From 350 events last year, we are over 600 now. And actually, this is, you know, Financial Literacy Month, so I'm here to celebrate with you this month.
And is it true that if you create a sketch in famous TV soaps, sketches that describe financial literacy issues, actually that has an effect on the public?
Yeah, this has been actually done in South Africa, and I have to say in several other countries, even in Russia. We were at the IMF and the World Bank last week, and several people were talking about the initiative. You know, 70 countries, by the way, have done a national strategy for financial literacy. So now there is a lot of evidence on that. So, you know, you have to find a way to make financial literacy and education appealing. So when you look at the public, you know, the public, you have to be in where the public is and what the public does. I mean, personally, I would like to be in the supermarket. You know, I would like to give this information in the supermarket. I would like to be at the hairdresser. You know, people are there, they have an hour time, rather than perhaps reading the magazine. I would like to give them a fun magazine about financial literacy. We have done a lot of program with the young. Actually, we opened Financial Literacy Month this year at the theater in Milan. So it was finance in the theater. We can make finance fun, easy, and be in the place where people are.
And in terms of policy prescriptions, in terms of what works and what doesn't work, is there anything we know about that?
There is a lot more emerging for this. Well, there was a lot of discussion this morning that, you know, what we are all trying to do is to do evaluation. You know, we want to be accountable and we want to put the money where it is much more productive. So several studies have been done. And I actually think if, you know, judging from that study, I think there is a higher return to putting money into the schools. Because, you know, if you help the young, they have a great asset, which is time. And so you can also reach a large group of the population. We have seen that financial education at work, where, you know, can find yet again a lot of people, could actually be important. And then you have to address also the group that can be multiplier of financial education. And on that sense, I think I want to point to women, because women care about others. If you financially educate women, I think you're going to have a very high return.
Well, thank you for being here. And thank you, listeners, for spending your time with us. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics, and I'll be here presenting this show until the UK Student Loan Company find out where I am. Bye.